The discovery of Harriet Osborne's overgrown property sent ripples through the pristine community of Mattock. Once a showcase home featured in shelter magazines, 256 Woodland Drive had transformed into a wild, untamed landscape that horrified the local HOA. What neighbors didn't realize was that this wasn't neglect, it was rebirth. Harriet, a former advertising executive pushed aside for younger talent, had undergone her own metamorphosis. The transformation of her property mirrored her personal evolution from corporate professional to something far more powerful. The change has become a cultural phenomenon since its 2022 release, resonating particularly with women over 40. Celebrities like Reese Witherspoon and Gillian Anderson have praised its empowering message, with Witherspoon calling it the revenge fantasy every woman needs. The novel sparked viral TikTok discussions about embracing midlife transformation and inspired countless book clubs dedicated to exploring its themes of female rage and power. Its popularity reflects a cultural shift in how we view women's aging, not as decline, but as an awakening to new forms of strength. Three women form the heart of this story, each discovering extraordinary abilities as they enter their perimenopausal years. Nessa James, a nurse and widow raising twin daughters, carries the inherited gift of seeing and communicating with the dead, specifically those who died violently. Her grandmother had explained this ability would first appear before puberty, then go dormant during childbearing years, before returning after the curse ends. Now in her 50s, Nessa's power has reawakened with disturbing intensity as she begins hearing the voices of murdered girls calling to her from Danskammer Beach. Harriet Osborne, once a brilliant advertising executive who created the groundbreaking Half the World menstruation campaign using actual red fluid instead of blue, discovers her connection to plant life after her husband leaves her for a younger woman. Her garden becomes an extension of herself, wild, untamed, and potentially deadly. She learns to harness the power of medicinal and poisonous plants, developing abilities that some neighbors whisper are witchcraft. Joe Levison rounds out the trio, a former hotel executive who lost her job after confronting a powerful guest who sexually assaulted an employee. During that confrontation, Joe discovered her own supernatural strength and heat generation, leaving a second-degree burn in the shape of her hand on the man's neck. Now running Furious Fitness, a women's gym, Joe's power manifests as intense heat that can melt metal and eventually ignite fires with just her touch. What binds these women isn't just their supernatural abilities, but their shared experience of society's dismissal. Each has faced some form of rejection or invisibility that women commonly experience as they age. Their powers emerge not as random gifts, but as manifestations of the rage, wisdom, and strength they've accumulated through decades of navigating a world designed to diminish them. When you hit a certain age, Harriet explains to Joe, you become invisible to most people. But that's when you're at your most dangerous. This invisibility becomes their greatest asset as they form an unlikely alliance to investigate a series of murders that the local authorities seem determined to ignore. The discovery of a young woman's decomposing body in a garbage bag on Danskammer Beach sets the plot in motion. Nessa, guided by her ability to see the dead, leads Joe and Harriet to the body. The victim, eventually identified as the girl in blue, is just the beginning. Nessa's visions reveal two more female spirits standing in the water, suggesting additional victims whose bodies rest on the ocean floor. These murders connect to a pattern of disappearances that authorities have consistently dismissed. When Mandy Welsh vanished 2 years earlier, police told her mother, Amber, that girls like her run away all the time, despite evidence to the contrary. The victims share a common profile: young women from disadvantaged backgrounds working service jobs whose disappearances generate little official concern. The investigation reveals a disturbing reality. The killer walks among them, likely someone respected in the community who can move without suspicion. when Rosamond Harding, wife of wealthy art dealer Spencer Harding, dies in a suspicious car accident after leaving a cryptic message for Joe and Harriet, the pieces begin to connect. In Rosamond's gym locker, secured with a combination spelling Faith, they find a disturbing Polaroid of the murdered girl. The novel brilliantly illustrates how society's indifference toward certain victims, particularly poor, young women of color, allows predators to operate with impunity. The authorities' dismissal of these disappearances as runaways reflect real-world patterns where missing persons cases receive dramatically different levels of attention based on the victim's race, class, and perceived social value. When Joe and Nessa attempt to report their findings to Police Chief John Rocca, they encounter institutional resistance. Rocca dismisses their concerns about the missing Amber Welsh, suggesting her criminal history explains her disappearance. This systemic failure forces the women to pursue justice through unconventional channels, ultimately leading them to podcast host Josh Gibbon, whose They Walk Among Us has 30 million listeners. A pivotal moment occurs when Joe's home is invaded by an intruder who attempts to kidnap her daughter Lucy. Though Joe manages to overpower the man, leaving a distinctive burn mark on his face from a heated poker, the attack crystallizes the stakes of their investigation. The official channels have not only failed to protect them, but may be actively working against them, a realization that sends shockwaves through their tight-knit group. The incident leaves Lucy traumatized, waking with nightmares, while Joe installs additional security measures and begins sleeping with a baseball bat beside her bed. This incident forces the women to confront a fundamental question: what happens when the systems designed to protect us are corrupted? As Franklin Reese, a detective sympathetic to their cause, explains, "Justice may be slow, but she's also relentless." Joe counters with the brutal reality: while we wait for evidence, another girl could be murdered. The tension between legal procedure and immediate action becomes increasingly unbearable as more evidence of corruption within the police department surfaces. The novel doesn't shy away from exploring the moral complexity of vigilante justice. When Harriet suggests killing Spencer Harding outright, neither Joe nor Nessa immediately dismisses the idea. Their hesitation reflects a profound disillusionment with traditional justice systems that consistently fail vulnerable victims. Each woman carries her own experiences of institutional failure. Joe's dismissed domestic violence complaints, Nessa's ignored workplace harassment, and Harriet's sister's case being buried by influential families. This theme connects to historical precedents referenced throughout the novel, creating a rich tapestry of women's resistance against injustice. Nessa recalls her grandmother's story about Miss Ella, who fed Mr. Cogdill to the gators after he raped two little girls in 1952. When Nessa questioned this vigilante justice, her grandmother explained, "The commandments only apply to humans. Nobody goes to hell for killing a monster." The story reveals how communities have long developed their own systems of justice when official channels fail them. Similarly, Harriet shares that she once burned down the house of a man who hurt her sister, timing it so he would lose everything but survive. A calculated act of revenge that haunts yet satisfies her. These stories establish a lineage of women who, when formal justice fails, create their own. Through generations of shared experiences, from church basements to beauty parlors, women have passed down these alternative methods of securing justice. The novel asks readers to consider, is vengeance sometimes necessary when systems of justice are fundamentally broken? More importantly, it explores how the weight of such decisions reshapes those who make them, as each woman grapples with the psychological toll of taking justice into their own hands. The Change brilliantly reframes menopause not as an ending, but as a powerful beginning. Throughout history, societies have feared and marginalized older women, branding them as witches, hags, or simply invisible. This novel reclaims that narrative, suggesting that what patriarchal cultures fear is not women's decline, but their ascension to new forms of power. Isabel, a wise woman who joins the trio later in the story, explains that women's lives have three stages: education, creation, and finally, protection. The third stage, which begins after reproductive years end, is one of potential great power. Women must destroy the world men built to suit their needs and desires, Isabel explains, so they can build a better world from its ashes. This framework provides a revolutionary perspective on menopause. The hot flashes, mood swings, and physical changes aren't failures of the female body, but transformations, metamorphoses into something new and potentially more powerful. Jo's night sweats manifest as literal fire she can control. Nessa's headaches signal the voices of the dead demanding justice. Harriet's connection to plant life deepens as she embraces her post-reproductive years. When Harriet tells Jo, that anger's like rocket fuel. Either it pushes you forward or it burns you alive. She articulates the novel's central metaphor. The physical and emotional intensity of perimenopause becomes a source of power rather than weakness. The novel also explores how society conditions women to see each other as competitors rather than allies. Jo, Nessa, and Harriet come from different backgrounds and would likely never have formed friendships under normal circumstances. Yet their shared experiences and emerging powers create a bond that transcends social boundaries. Their collective strength proves far more formidable than their individual abilities. As the investigation deepens, the women discover that the murders connect to Culling Point, an exclusive community where billionaires and CEOs live in isolation from ordinary people. The name itself carries dark historical significance. In the 1600s, English colonists massacred native people on this land, then killed deer they believed were possessed by Satan. This history of violence continues in the present day. Claude Marchand, who initially presents herself as an ally to the women, is revealed to be complicit in a horrific scheme. Working with Leonard Shaw, the king of Culling Point, Claude has been recruiting vulnerable young women for wealthy men under the guise of offering them opportunities. When Spencer Harding joined their circle, girls began disappearing and dying. The Culling Point conspiracy represents the novel's most damning indictment of wealth and power. The ultra-rich residents have created a parallel universe where their depravity goes unchecked, protected by the very authorities meant to enforce justice. Chief Rocca is revealed to be not just negligent, but actively involved in the murders, having assaulted Amber Welsh years earlier and continuing to prey on young women even after Spencer Harding's death. Claude's justification for her role, that she extracted millions for charity from the men and protected most girls, exemplifies how systems of abuse perpetuate themselves through moral compromises. "I never expected Spencer to kill her," Claude claims about Faith Reed, a girl she personally recruited. This defense rings hollow against the reality of her actions. The novel doesn't shy away from exploring how women can betray other women when incentivized by systems of power. Claude's transformation from victim of financial ruin to facilitator of abuse illustrates how the cycle of exploitation can turn victims into perpetrators. The climax arrives when Jo, finally embracing the full scope of her supernatural power, ignites the yellow Scotch broom bushes Harriet had methodically planted throughout Culling Point over the previous months. The invasive plants, chosen specifically for their high oil content and explosive burning properties, create an unstoppable inferno that consumes the palatial mansions of the wealthy predators who had long believed their money made them untouchable. Harriet, having meticulously disabled the sprinkler systems and emergency response protocols earlier that day, watches from a weathered fishing boat as decades of accumulated justice manifests in towering flames against the night sky. This fiery reckoning represents more than mere revenge. It's a ritual of purification that echoes ancient cleansing ceremonies. The land itself, carrying the weight of centuries of violence, from the colonial massacres of indigenous peoples to the modern predation of society's most vulnerable, is finally cleansed by the transformative power of fire. The novel suggests that some corruptions run so deep within institutional structures and privileged communities that they cannot be reformed through conventional means, but must be burned away completely to allow for new growth, much like certain forests require periodic burning to maintain their ecological health. The epilogue, set 5 years later, reveals the far-reaching consequences of the women's actions. Culling Point remains a charred testament to that night, its burned ruins now protected as a whale conservation area where migrating pods gather in unprecedented numbers. The third murdered girl is finally identified as 15-year-old foster child Mae Jones, whose death had gone uninvestigated for years in a system that routinely overlooks missing children from marginalized backgrounds. Lucy, now 12, channels her trauma into strength by attending self-defense classes funded by Leonard Shaw's seized estate, teaching other young girls to protect themselves. Nessa and Franklin, having found unexpected love amid the ashes, take daily walks along Danscommer Beach, where they maintain an informal network supporting abuse survivors. Harriet and Celeste continue their quiet campaign of vengeance against those whose names appeared in Claude's extensive files, methodically dismantling networks of exploitation across the country through careful manipulation of financial records and strategic exposure of secrets. The novel's resolution deliberately avoids simple moral conclusions or easy answers. While the women's vigilante justice succeeded where official channels failed, exposing corruption, preventing future crimes, and providing closure to victims' families, the cost was monumentally high in both human and material terms. Their actions exist in a morally ambiguous space that challenges readers to consider what justice truly means in a fundamentally unjust world, where traditional legal systems often protect the powerful while failing society's most vulnerable members. Throughout the novel, the theme of inheritance, both biological and spiritual, emerges as a central force shaping the characters' destinies. Nessa's ability to see the dead runs in her family, passing specifically from grandmother to granddaughter, skipping generations like a recessive gene expressing itself in carefully chosen vessels. When teaching Nessa the art of drawing ghosts, her grandmother revealed the profound metaphysical nature of their gift. A bit of their soul gets transferred to the paper, where it's mixed with a little bit of your own. This creates not just an image, but a binding contract, a sacred obligation that ties Nessa to the pursuit of justice for the dead. The transmission of power manifests differently in Jo's lineage. Her daughter Lucy demonstrates an innate understanding of danger and protection that mirrors her mother's supernatural abilities. During conversations about personal safety, Lucy's terrifyingly creative threats, ranging from elaborate booby traps to detailed scenarios of revenge, suggest she's inherited more than just her mother's fierce protective instincts. This generational connection implies that the women's abilities aren't random anomalies, but part of a longer lineage of female power that patriarchal systems have systematically attempted to suppress throughout history. The novel delves deeply into the darker side of inheritance through its exploration of generational trauma. Amber Welsh's story serves as a haunting testament to how violence echoes through time. Her sexual assault by Coach John Rocca during her high school years created ripples of destruction that touched not only her life, but fundamentally altered her daughter Mandy's existence. When Amber finally fought back, setting fire to Rocca's boat in a desperate act of retaliation, the justice system failed her completely. She was sent to juvenile detention while he remained free, eventually rising to become police chief, his power growing alongside his capacity for predation. This cycle of inherited trauma and resistance connects to the novel's broader historical framework, reaching back through centuries of persecution. The women branded as witches in earlier eras possessed knowledge of healing, of nature, of power structures that threatened established hierarchies. Their modern counterparts, Jo, Nessa, and Harriet, consciously reclaim this legacy not as a curse, but a birthright, transforming historical persecution into contemporary power. Their abilities represent not just personal gifts, but a collective inheritance of resistance against oppression, passed down through generations of women who refused to be silenced. The novel suggests that this inheritance of power comes with both responsibility and risk. Each woman must choose how to use her gifts, knowing that the same abilities that allow them to protect and seek justice also mark them as targets for those who fear female power. This duality of gift and burden, power and persecution, runs like a thread through the generations, binding past and present in an unbroken chain of female strength and survival. The change fundamentally challenges how stories about violence against women are traditionally constructed and consumed. When true crime podcast host Josh Gibbon approaches Joe at the crime scene, she delivers a pointed critique of true crime media by challenging him to name the victims of the headhunter serial killer rather than just the killer himself. His telling inability to recall a single victim's name while easily reciting details about the perpetrator starkly illustrates how victims are often reduced to nameless props in narratives that sensationalize and inadvertently glorify their murderers. This meta-commentary weaves throughout the novel's carefully constructed narrative architecture. Unlike conventional crime narratives that delve deep into killers' psychological profiles and troubled backstories, The Change deliberately centers the experiences, voices, and perspectives of the victims and the women fighting for justice. Spencer Harding, the wealthy predator at the center of the investigation, remains purposefully underdeveloped as a character, a calculated choice that denies him the narrative prominence and psychological exploration typically afforded to fictional villains. Instead, the story illuminates the lives, dreams, and relationships of the women he victimized. The women's reclamation of narrative control manifests in multiple powerful ways throughout their personal journeys. Harriet definitively rejects her advertising agency's attempts to bring her back after their discriminatory firing, refusing to let them control her professional story or worth. Nessa takes ownership of Mandy Welsh's memory by insisting on delivering the eulogy herself, ensuring that Mandy is remembered as a full person rather than just another tragic victim. Joe transforms her humiliating dismissal from the hotel into an act of empowerment by creating Furious Fitness, a sanctuary specifically designed for women to build strength and community. This reclamation extends powerfully into how the women view and discuss their changing bodies and social roles. Rather than internalizing cultural narratives that paint menopausal women as diminished, invisible, or past their prime, they discover unprecedented power and possibility in their transformation. Harriet's insight to Nessa about the nature of attraction cuts to the heart of how women's self-image has been commodified. Ad people like me convinced women that being attractive was all about rosy cheeks and red lips because we could sell lipstick and bronzer. There was no way to make money off the kind of allure I'm talking about. This realization exposes how commercial interests have shaped and limited women's understanding of their own power and appeal. The novel demonstrates how reclaiming narratives happens not just through what stories are told, but through who tells them and how they're framed. Each woman's journey represents a different aspect of taking back control, whether it's over their bodies, their professional lives, their communities, or the very ways their stories are told and remembered. In the novel's final confrontation, Isabel articulates the ultimate mission. Women must destroy the world men built to suit their needs and desires so they can build a better world from its ashes. This statement encapsulates the revolutionary heart of The Change. The novel doesn't advocate for simple revenge, but for fundamental transformation. The systems that failed Mandy Welsh, Faith Reed, and Mee Jones aren't broken. They're functioning exactly as designed, protecting the powerful at the expense of the vulnerable. Real change requires not reform, but reimagination. This perspective offers a profound metaphor for menopause itself. The end of fertility isn't a loss, but a liberation from biological imperatives that have shaped women's lives and social roles for millennia. The change of the title refers not just to hormonal shifts, but to the potential for women to change the world once freed from reproductive expectations. The epilogue shows glimpses of this new world being built. Lucy attends self-defense classes, gaining skills her mother never had at her age. Nessa and Franklin demonstrate a partnership based on mutual respect rather than traditional gender roles. Harriet and Celeste's relationship flourishes outside heteronormative expectations. Yet the novel resists simplistic utopian conclusions. Harriet continues releasing spiders near the thinking bench of a CEO implicated in Claude's files, a reminder that vigilance remains necessary. The work of transformation is ongoing, carried forward by each generation of women who discover their own unique powers as they age into wisdom. In its final pages, The Change leaves readers with a provocative question. What world might we build if we valued women's anger, experience, and power as much as we valued their youth, beauty, and fertility? The answer, like the women at the heart of this story, contains both destruction and creation, the necessary burning away of what no longer serves us, and the careful cultivation of something new.